This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, welcome to Really with Tom and Dave. Although I shouldn't really need to tell people that if they're watching, they should know what they're watching.
But it's like a welcome. I mean, someone shows up at your house, you say, welcome. Hey, welcome to Really with Tom and Dave.
My house that you're in.
Exactly. Yes. How are you, buddy?
Well, welcome. Welcome. I'm well. It's getting very wintry here.
Yeah, baby.
Yeah.
Holidays. Yeah. Woohoo.
Yeah. I'll be flying out to LA tomorrow. I'll be flying out to LA.
We're ready to see you.
I'll see you. Yeah.
Yes.
Looking forward to it.
Even Christmas Eve, potentially. We'll see.
Yeah. Yes.
I don't know what's going on, but love to have you.
Yeah. And but I'm looking forward to today.
Today is awesome. Yes. I was all like, oh my gosh. I was like, got all these questions written down. We got a fantastic, fantastic guest. To close out 2023, we're doing it in style. This is our sort of last podcast of the year, I guess. And so without further ado, Lieutenant Commander Alex Dietrich served as one of the nation's first female strike fighter aviators as an FA-18 pilot from 2001 to 2021. She flew in Operation Iraqi Freedom and Operation Enduring Freedom. She has since taught leadership, ethics, and critical thinking at the George Washington University, U.S. Naval Academy, and now serves on the faculty of the University of Colorado School of Engineering in Boulder. Alex is an advocate for Legacy Flight Academy, a foundation that promotes diversity in aviation, and Wings for Val, supporting women in aviation. Alex is also currently part of the Aircrew Leadership Council for Americans for Safe Aerospace, and we're thrilled to have her with us today. She was also a witness of one of probably the most famous UAP cases in our history.
One of the most important incidents.
Our modern day Roswell. And hi, Alex.
Hi. Hi from Alex. Boulder.
Hi. Hello. Good to see you again.
Good to see you. Hey, Dave. Hi, Tom.
Great to see you. Thanks for being here. Thank you for your service. This is great. Been really looking forward to this conversation. And so, you know, look, so many cool aspects of the story. I mean, we want to talk about Tic Tac and all that, but I'm just, your journey is so interesting. I'm just curious, like, who are your heroes growing up?
Oh, wow. So when I was growing up, I was really into math and science. Mm-hmm. And so I was very fortunate to go to a school in Chicago, the Illinois Math and Science Academy. And so our heroes were the founders, Leon Letterman, Nobel physicist, and Carl Sagan, and you know, these folks who had big dreams and sort of wild ideas about what might be possible and out there, but also brought the receipts. You know, right. they made sure that it was grounded in data and evidence and tangible science.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. When you're at that school, are you thinking, I want to apply this sort of engineering or this science to being a pilot, or were you still kind of exploring? Like, how did that come? How did that become something, a dream of yours?
I mean, yeah, most mathematicians do become fighter pilots, I believe. Yeah. Right?
Really? Statistically?
I think so. Yeah. Statistically, yeah.
I definitely wouldn't know. Yeah.
You can have any degree and be a fighter pilot. I flew with folks who were geography majors. Yeah. No offense to the geography majors.
But no, I mean, I assume that's a component, right? I mean, it's good.
Yeah, I guess.
Know where you are, right?
Yeah. Well, I'm a high school dropout, so I'm not going to slam geography majors.
I had zero interest in actually applying the Math and Science Foundation. I had a college counselor in the latter years of high school who said, you need to declare a major and you need to have a plan. You have to, and that's what it sounded like when he was talking to me. It was this very like thunderous, ominous voice. Mm-hmm. And he said, you got to get it all, get your shit together, Alex. He didn't say that, but he did not so many words. And we had these tests, we had these assessments to figure out what we would be well-suited to do. We took personality tests, we took these career, you know, you should be a park ranger or you should be a surgeon. And my test came back all over the place, you know, you should be a surgeon in the park kind of thing. And so, yeah. And so he said, look, where do you see yourself when you're 40? Look back. What do you want to have accomplished? Where do you want to be? And I thought, okay. This is an interesting thought experiment. All the 40-year-olds I know are going through a midlife crisis. They're on their second career. They're getting divorced. And he said, no. That's not what I had in mind.
What do I have to choose from?
And so I said, no, this is actually really helpful. Thank you, Mr. Hernandez. I said, this tells me that I need to have my midlife crisis up front, that I need to get it out of the way. And then I can settle down and think about career and family and all of that.
So you bought a Corvette.
I on my forms, right, where it said, what do you want to major in and what do you want to do with your life? I said, I either want to be a rock star or a fighter pilot. And I'm tone deaf, so I couldn't be a rock star. And so one thing led to another, and I found myself in the strike fighter pipeline.
Yeah. And because you didn't just decide to be a pilot, you decided to become a fighter pilot.
Yeah. Did you? I mean, there's got to be a moment where you're like, shit, this is really happening. I mean, I'm really doing this.
And that, and you're also enlisting in the military to become that.
Right. Well, for a hot minute, I thought maybe I would go to the military academies. First, I thought I would go to the Air Force because I naively thought if you want to fly, you go into the Air Force. But actually, if you want to fly, you go into the Navy because the Navy has more flight opportunities. But then, it was all about me. It was about my selfish adventure. It was about, you know, scratching my own itch. And you had to get a degree. You had to get a 4-year degree. So I went through ROTC in order to graduate and commission. And I graduated in May of 2001, went off to flight school, ground school. And then I had my first flight in the aircraft on 9/11. So
walk us through that day.
Yeah, it was a nightmare, as it was, you know, I think for the world, it was a paradigm shift. And I realized it's not about me and my selfish adventure. And I've taken an oath. I am a military officer. What the hell does that mean? And how do I do this? And how do I contribute in a meaningful way? So, I've had an adventure, certainly, traveled around the world several times and saw a UFO along the way. So, you know, when I advise my students, I always tell them, you know, you think you have a plan, you think you want something or you know something, and the universe will have its way with you. And, you know, you can just try to make the best of it.
Did you say your first flight was so it was like the first time you're in the
September of 2001. Yeah.
So you're piloting for the first time that day.
Yeah. We didn't get very far. Obviously everything was grounded.
Turned around. Right.
Situation of all. Yeah. But then, you know, and the base that I was going through this flight training, it was in Texas. We didn't have security around the perimeter. It used to be that we would just drive in every morning. We didn't have to stop at a checkpoint at the sentry and show an ID or have our vehicle searched. And so there was a delay. All of our training stopped for a few weeks while they literally physically went around and secured the base. And we were on hold. And then when we came back, it was a totally different mindset. You know, we had this sense of urgency because we were catching up. And then also this bigger, this paradigm shift of we are going to go into harm's way, and we are going to go and I don't want to say retaliate, but we are going to go deal with this new situation of
and
national.
Were you deployed overseas after 9/11?
Right. So the flight training that was the very beginning when 9/11 happened, and so I had to go through primary where we learned to just the basics. The basic maneuvers, the basic aerodynamics, and for me that was in the T-34 Charlie Turbo Mentor, just a little single, kind of like a little Cessna or Piper that you would see at an airfield. And then I went through the T-45 pipeline, so T-45 Alpha Goshawks. Those are a jet aircraft. And then into the F-18 Fleet Replacement Squadron. So by the time I got through that whole several phases of that pipeline, it was the summer of 2004 when I joined my fleet squadron, the VFA 41 Black Aces.
Yeah. And then something else happened in 2004. I'm trying to remember what it was.
I don't recall.
The kind of added.
Was like an election or something, or was it a.
No, I know what it was. Earthquake. You saw you and this other fella, David Fravor, you encountered a 40-foot long Tic Tac.
Oh, that, yes.
Yeah, that seemed to be untethered from reality in front of you.
Right.
This is all happening at once.
You're deployed, but you're deployment,
right? At this point?
No. So I just joined the squadron.
Yeah.
I actually joined the squadron as they were conducting a large force exercise in Alaska. And so we went up to Alaska and we flew around Denali and conducted the exercises up there. And then when we came back to the States, but Alaska is a state.
Well, yeah.
back to the continent.
Allegedly, yes.
It should be a province, but whatever.
Yeah. Right. But we came home, then we were preparing to deploy. So our pre-deployment workups include conducting these exercises and training from our own jet base, which on the West Coast is in Lemoore, California, which is not beach and sand California. It's middle of nowhere in the San Joaquin Valley, which is good for flying because people don't complain about the noise and there's access to plenty of ranges and open space to do our maneuvers and practice on our, these target ranges where we can do drop ordnance and not bother anybody. But so then the aircraft carriers that we deploy on, that we actually go out and do these around the world missions, at the time our carrier was based out of San Diego. And so we come in together, we converge, and we conduct these exercises. And so that's what was happening in November of 2004. It was a pre-deployment workup cycle where we had gone down to stay on the ship for several weeks and then integrate our operations, exercise our systems, our hardware, and practice our maneuvers off the coast of Southern California.
I do have to ask a question. How scary is it to land on an aircraft carrier? I mean, how is that? Is that as advertised, as terrifying as it seems, or?
Pretty much. It's
what's your first landing like on an aircraft? I mean, do you have to loop around a few times?
So I actually don't remember my very first air carrier landing, and it was on the East Coast off of Florida in the T-45 in the Goshawk. And I should say that, you know, the reason that it takes us a while to get through flight school is because it's very systematic. It's very methodical. Everything has a checklist. Everything has a curriculum. We have ground school courses. We have simulators where you sit there and you touch the buttons and you practice the flow and you practice the hand-eye coordination and look at the sight pictures before you're even in an aircraft. And then when you're in the aircraft, you know, you have a flight instructor with you and you watch one, you do another one, you do it again and again. And we have at the airfield the Fresnel lens, this array of lights and mirrors that replicate the aircraft carrier's system. It's what you use to come in on glide slope. You want to be on glide slope and you want to be on airspeed. And so there's this, you can imagine this, if the ship is right here, there's this sort of cone coming back out. And so you come around in your aircraft and you get into that cone and then it narrows down. You need to keep on the numbers. And so you practice that a lot at the field before you go to the boat. Mm-hmm. And it's still kind of
Yeah, it's still building. You're still going like, oh shit, I still have to actually do this. Yeah.
So my first time off the coast of Florida, we had an instructor lead us out, you know, like little baby birds on the wing, all in formation. And we went out and he said over the radio, you know, there it is at 11 o'clock or 10 o'clock low. And I look out and all I saw was water. And I couldn't see because the ship was so small at the altitude we were at. And we weren't that high. But I remember looking at it and thinking, well, I tried. You know, I made it this far.
Yeah, I'm up here as well. Yeah. How long can I stay up here?
Yeah. You know, well, gave it a shot. And then, you know, we spiral down and there's a whole, you know, again, pre-brief practice maneuver to get down to the altitude where you're sort of in this pattern. And anybody who's flown around an airfield understands the pattern, you know, the sight picture and that there's set airspeeds and configurations. And so once I got down into that mode, and I had my tapes turned on to record it. And so I'm chatting and I'm talking to myself, you know, saying, hi, mom, hi. you know, and then there's that moment where I finally see the ship and I go, we made it this far. Okay, well, good try. You know, it's okay if we don't make it any further. And then it goes silent. And so that's where I think that I went from my sort of prefrontal cortex back to the limbic brain and just went off of muscle memory. Because I land, you know, the arresting cable sort of stretches out and then I start to taxi around and follow the direction of the folks on the deck. And then I start talking again and I go, oh, wow, this is exciting. And holy shit, that just happened. Yeah. But when I watched the tape later, you know, I was sharing it with my family at the holidays or something. I said, you know, what happened? Did you lose did the audio cut out? And I said, no, I just must have stopped talking because I was overwhelmed.
You were in the zone.
Yeah.
You were
in
the survival zone and a training zone.
I was going to say, when you're actually landing on the aircraft carrier, it's a little more unpredictable than landing on a simulation on land, isn't it? Because the air, it isn't stationary.
Yeah, things got to be, moving.
Right. And in that initial, when we're students, the conditions have to be very calm sea state, and the weather has to be really good. But then when you get into the fleet and you have more experience and more confidence, then we really push the envelope in terms of minimums of cloud layers and maximums of pitching deck, you know, this sort of Bucky Bronco.
Yeah.
And then,
yeah.
So besides the Fresnel lens, this light and mirror contraption that we reference with our eyes to keep us in that right space that we're supposed to be in, there's also a set of individuals, they're called LSOs, landing signal officers, on the deck. And I don't know, maybe you've seen the, what's the spoof of Top Gun?
Is it Hot Shots?
Hot Shots, yes.
How do you say Hot Shots?
Hot Shots. Shots? Yes.
I don't know.
Yes. You know, where the guys are, they've got the glasses and they've got the paddles and they're waving and stuff. So those folks are their eyes are calibrated after watching so many folks come in. And so they help us. They're on the radio talking and letting us know if it's.
They're saying, yeah, this ain't going to work out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just
forget it. Yeah. Just regret all of your life decisions.
Turn around. Exactly. This was all for naught. Was your family like when you said, I'm going to be a Navy fighter pilot? Was that like, oh, yeah, that sounds like Alex, of course, makes perfect sense. Or was it, are you crazy? Like what was there? Or there's a mix of opinions on that?
Yeah. No, they were supportive. I don't think they really understood what I was getting into. And it wasn't like I just was, you know, graduated and was suddenly a fighter pilot. There were several, it was a, you know, slow drip disclosure, if you will, that, you know, at first I was going to flight school and, you know, I could have flown helicopters. I could have flown, you know, cargo transport. And so it took a while to evolve. And again, this sort of 9/11.
That changes
in the background. That sort of changed everybody's mindset.
You have an ability to do something like that's what's sort of interesting. Like, you know, I mean, I don't know. It's just, there was so much helplessness, so much of a feeling of helplessness. And I don't know, what was that like to know you could do something about it in some ways, you know what I mean? Respond, you could react to it in a meaningful way.
Yeah. You know, honestly, I don't think at the time I was really thinking about that. I was really busy learning these systems, learning these maneuvers, you know, was relatively isolated. These locations where we have our flight schools and our flight training, where we go on detachments to practice, they're in the middle of nowhere.
And these workups and the training, like the procedures you go through, like how much time is spent preparing you for UFO encounters?
None. Zero.
Well, that seems like an awfully big oversight, considering.
No, we train like we fight so that we can fight like we train. We don't like surprises. We want everything to be muscle memory. We want when things are overwhelming that we can fall back on our checklists and fall back on our training. So, you know, we were preparing for air-to-air and air-to-ground missions. And we set up those scenarios. We set up the target ranges. We set up our briefs and everything so that it's these, you know, these expected normal scenarios, and some of those are quite terrifying. Some of those are, it's hard to wrap your head around. You know, if I am doing this, then things have gone terribly wrong,
right,
in the world. Mm-hmm. And so there really wasn't either space in the curriculum or appetite to inject a UFO protocol.
So you'd be looking at scenarios including up to like a nuclear engagement, I'm guessing.
Right.
Which is something I think most of us try to avoid thinking about at all.
Right.
As opposed to thinking about, well, if a nuclear war breaks out, what is my responsibility and what do I have to do? So right. That's a pretty huge thing to...
It's incredible to contemplate.
To even have to contemplate, yeah. And so, yeah, so in the throes, this is still, I guess, this is earlier in your career as a fighter pilot, and then this sort of weird event gets thrown at you.
No, I was just going to say. I mean, there's going to be a portion of our audience that has heard this story. There's also a big portion of our audience that haven't heard this story. If you can take us through that day, when did you meet David Fravor? Is it around the same time, or have you guys been working together for a long time at this point? Or
so he was the executive officer, turning over to be the commanding officer of the VFA 41 Strike Fighter Squadron when I checked in that summer of 2004. And so by November 14th, 2004, which is the date of the event that we're talking about here, he was the commanding officer of the squadron and one of the most senior aircrew, if not the most senior pilot in the entire air wing. So an air wing consists of multiple squadrons. So you have your Hornet squadrons, you have your helicopter squadrons, you have your Prowler at the time, which is now the Growler, so your electronic attack squadron. And so you have multiple groups of officers and enlisted maintainers who are responsible for their batch of aircraft. And then all of that is sitting on an aircraft carrier that has, up to 3,000 people taking care of all of the, from their radars and sensors and weapons to, care and feeding of all of these people, making sure that, we have drinking water and we have supply and logistics, food and fuel, and everything in between. So it is really this magnificent orchestra of people and logistics. And so, David Fravor is the commanding officer of one squadron among this entire, the carrier operations, and then the carrier is within the carrier strike group, several other ships. So if you've ever played Battleship,
I have.
Yes.
Close as I've gotten to combat. Yeah. Yes, I have played battle.
So the carrier is that big piece. And then you have probably a submarine and a cruiser and a destroyer and the other bits. So you can imagine this is a sort of a game of battleship.
Yeah, which I find very stressful. Just, yeah.
Yes.
So, yeah, just the
game. And we have to stay on the grids, actually. I didn't know if you knew that we have to.
Well, yeah, you got
to
line up, right? Like I've got,
Yeah, we're not allowed to go diagonally.
Oh, I quietly move my pieces around.
Yeah, that's cheating, Dave. It's not.
No, I didn't know.
That's messed up.
That's why I don't play with you.
Yeah,
and so you're playing this giant version of Battleship.
The real version.
Yes. So here we are.
You're on a nice training mission.
Yeah, it's hey, let's go out and practice. We don't have any live ordnance. We're off the coast of San Diego, so we want to be fierce but not reckless. And we launch, late morning, clear skies, calm waters, and we are expecting to go out and scrimmage against another squadron. So we have a pre-briefed working area, some coordinates that we have said, this is our piece of the sky to deconflict from other people working in this military operating area. MOA is what we call it. And we're not expecting any.
Yeah. And it's just you and you're flying your jet and David Fravor's flying his. So it's just the two of you out on this maneuver.
So we each have a weapons systems officer on board. And so two aircraft, four people.
Mm-hmm.
Four sets of eyes, four brains, and then there are other aircraft from our carrier strike group in the vicinity, But we're not expecting commercial airliners. We're not expecting any other traffic to be coming through our space.
Yeah. It's restricted airspace that you're in.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so we launch and we're in our administrative phase of flight. So this is when we, you know, we've just taken off. We make sure that everything's working on our aircraft. You know, we're making sure that we, our comms are working, our radios are good. This is when we have a drink, take a snack, do all of that before we get into our tactical phase of flight.
A soft drink.
Yeah. You're eating lunch up there in the plane?
Just pop a little soda. And, no, but we carry, Camelbacks or things like that. And so if you need water and hydration. Yeah.
And some pemmican.
I don't know what that is.
What is that?
It's a Native American form of a dried meat.
So it's jerky.
Does that come with every jet?
It's jerky. Yeah, it's
okay.
It's
jerky.
Yeah, it's jerky.
We all know it is jerky. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah.
I call it a meat stick.
Yes,
meat stick.
That sounds rude. So you're there. You're having your sip of water, and things are still normal at this point.
Things are normal. Things are boring. Really, it's day in the office, and then the air traffic controller for our military exercise. So they're on another ship, but they're part of our carrier strike group. They come up and they say, you know, hey, we're going to give you vectors to this contact. And there's a bit of pushback because we say, no, that's not where we're going. We briefed, we were going over here. And, they say, we need you to check this out. It's a real world contact. And so that's the point where we got excited and said, oh, okay, post 9/11, we're off the coast of California and we should all, the hair on the back of our necks should stand up. And again, I'm the most junior person in the flight and still learning everything and feeling a bit overwhelmed by it all. And so I asked the more senior weapon systems officer in my backseat. I said, what do you think is going on? And he said, I don't know, maybe it's drug runners coming up the coast, from
like
Mexico.
Private planes, right? It's going into airspace that aren't, maybe.
Yeah, they're trying to evade our radars and sneak up with some contraband or something like that. And so I said, that's exciting. That is real world. But what are we going to do about it? We can intercept them, but we don't have any weapons on board. Would we be cleared to engage them anyway, or are we just gonna give them very stern looks,
and scare them away?
That'd be enough for me, probably not drug runners.
Still buzz them pretty alarmingly, I imagine.
Right, so that we could nudge them and strongly suggestive wing flashes to get them to try to maybe land at Brownfield. So, which is parallel runway to Tijuana International, by the way, which I almost tried to land on once. Thought I was going into Brown and I was lined
up in
Tijuana.
Quick trip to TJ, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So as this radar picture is evolving and the tracks are coming towards a merge plot, which is where the little dots on their radar screen are becoming indistinguishable. We start to look outside and we try to pick up a visual tally. And this is where, sort of the commotion begins of folks shouting on the radio between our two aircraft and the four people. So we have two radio channels, one that we use to talk up and out, so talking to those air traffic controllers and people outside of our flight, and then a radio that we talk in. It's our tactical channel, so between the two aircraft. And then in each aircraft, you have the ICS or the intercom between the front seat and the back seat. So there's multiple conversations going on at the same time, and all of them are getting excited as there's a visual contact or tally of this water disturbance, which I don't know whether it's related to the UFO that we saw or not, but if it hadn't been for the water disturbance, I don't know that I would have picked up a tally, because it acted as a sort of funneling feature or an anchor point for me to get a visual on the white water and then see this tic-tac flying above it. So we call it a tic-tac because that's what it looked like. It looked like the little white breath mints. Dave, do they have those in Canada?
They do, but they're 40% smaller. So it's, the value isn't as good. Yeah.
Yeah.
A smaller tic-tac.
So,
okay. Sorry. Go ahead, Alex. He distracted us.
No, I'm still trying to think about like how the little, the packaging
would
work.
Yeah, I know. It's like a... completely round, yeah. I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. Everything's big. Everything's bigger in America. That's just one of the things we live with as Canadians. Everything's That's bigger and brighter. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's actually on our money.
We try.
In Latin. And
yeah. So you're seeing this tic-tac.
Wait, can I ask about, can I ask about the white water though? Because
you're asking me or
Alex? That does seem coincident. I'm going to ask Alex, Dave,
okay, all right.
If you don't mind.
She's our
guest today.
All right.
I have always been curious about, I mean, it does seem coincidental that that was occurring around the appearance of the tic-tac, I suppose. I mean, did you, in retrospect or in the moment, attribute it at all to perhaps the movement of the tic-tac creating some effect? Or did you believe or detect that there might be something under the water or see anything that might be under the water that was making that commotion?
So in the moment, I had no idea what was causing the white water, and I had no sense of what the tic-tac was.
Mm-hmm.
When we came back to the ship and we were debriefing with Intel and trying to say, well, what could it have been, right? Let's brainstorm some theories and some alternative theories. One of the theories was that we might have seen a submarine launching something, and that it was, you know, going under that's what was happening there. I have since been reassured that there was no submarine in the area, and it wouldn't make sense that there would be a live fire or a launch or a test of anything.
Sure.
And the disturbance was large, right? It was, like I've heard it described as the size of a 777 jet or?
Yeah, so for like a microsecond, I went from being excited that we were going to intercept some drug runners to thinking, oh no, whatever we were after has crashed and is sinking. And now we are, on scene search and rescue.
Mm-hmm.
And so my heart sank a bit just thinking, you know, man, there could be souls on board. And then the tic-tac entered, and then I was like, whoa, what? You know, so it was kind of an emotional roller coaster from being excited to being
Yeah, it's sad, a lot going on in a very short span of time. Yeah.
Right. Sort of later in the debrief, being angry that there might have been a potential blue-on-blue situation, to them being reassured that it wasn't, you know, so all sorts
blue
of—
Blue-on-blue? What's
blue That it might have been a submarine testing.
Right.
You know, a missile fire or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Got it.
And that we could have been sort of vectored into that test range. But it wasn't. It wasn't a test range.
And it flies past. Excuse me. Now I'm hitting my mic. It flies past and you guys follow, or it comes back to you, or what's the...
Yeah. So Dave Fravor, the commanding officer, and the lead in this flight. So he was senior ranking and also the more senior aviator and in the position in the flight to engage. He calls that he's in to circle, that he's engaged, and I stay in high cover. So that just means like, hey, I'm going to hang out up here because I don't know what's going on and I'm not really sure what to do. So, he has this strange engagement with it, and it's moving in a way that doesn't follow what we would expect, and even though I was relatively new to the fleet, I had flown enough and seen enough of similar and dissimilar aircraft. So similar being other Hornets and Blue Air or things that are in our inventory. Mm-hmm. And then dissimilar would be, you know, Red Air and things that we would expect to be coming from other adversaries. And we study these, you know, we study the flight envelopes. We want to be able to optimize our performance and be able to outmaneuver or take advantage of, you know, areas in the envelope of other aircraft so that we can get into their kill zone and get a shot off. So we have this discerning sort of calibrated sight picture, or we're used to seeing turn radiuses and angles and just the physics of flight as we would expect something that requires, you know, our normal fuel and our normal propulsion and our normal flight control surfaces, whether it's ailerons or stabs or rudders, you know, we're used to that. Mm-hmm. And so this didn't have any of those. It was smooth. It was, it didn't have a smoke trail. It didn't have any visible means of propulsion. And so we couldn't really figure out how it was moving, both moving quickly and then also seeming to stop and hover or reverse and
yeah, because
you have go ahead, Dave.
No, I was going to say it's essentially moving like something that is massless in the air, right? It's able to like make right angle turns at speed and like instantaneous, you know, almost like if you were pointing a laser pointer, you could make those kind of maneuvers, but nothing with mass that was affected by inertia should be able to do what it was doing, right?
Yeah, it wasn't. I mean, I don't want to speculate about the mass.
But it wasn't adhering.
It wasn't adhering to our laws of physics. Yeah,
yeah, and it was something that showed up on radar, so it wasn't just
right. And so that's why we ended up there in the first place. And I think you know, and I didn't, so this is part of the frustration that we had as air crew, and that I have today, is that, you know, in the time since, I have become aware of the fact that they were tracking this anomaly or this anomalous behavior on the radar for days, if not a few weeks prior, and I get that they thought that it was just their system glitching, and they actually turned it off and turned it back on, as you do when a computer is, you know, sort of not cooperating or not behaving the way you expect it to. And so we were the first flight airborne when they were actively getting these strange hits, things that were strange altitudes and airspeeds and jumping around in these strange ways. And so, you know, they vectored us. They it was a target of opportunity. They said, hey, we've got aircraft airborne. Let's go see if there's something there. I think they were as surprised as we were that there was something there.
Because this is
many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
My question, you are seeing it both with your own eyes and through instrumentation on your plane, correct? Or is it
So our my aircraft didn't get it on our aircraft radar, but the larger USS Princeton radar was that's what the air traffic controller was using to vector us. Yeah. And that's, you know, yeah. the trend that they had been seeing. And so, you know, in hindsight, they should have said to the air crew, hey, we're getting these strange hits. They don't make sense. If and when we have a hit when there's an aircraft airborne, because we're not out there 24/7. And this is something that, you know, I think a lot of the folks who are debating whether there is a conspiracy or this, you know, that there needs to be disclosure, that there's all this data and information out there. There's this assumption that there's this 24/7 data collection stream, but there isn't. So in our case, you know, what I wish the controllers would have done is said, hey, we're getting these strange hits. If and when we have aircraft airborne, when we're getting a hit, we're going to vector you. And that would have allowed us as operators to have the conversation with each other about what other tools do we want to have? What, you know, do we want to bring binoculars? Do we want to bring, I don't know if we had GoPros at the time, but, you know, do we want to bring a handheld SLR camera? Do we want to bring any night vision goggles, even though it was daytime? You know, maybe we would just sort of have a UFO hunting kit and a bag ready to go. And then you have those, you know, check that the batteries are fresh and charged and make sure that everything's set. But in the moment, we were so surprised that our flight didn't even turn on our tapes to record. Because again, we were in an administrative phase of flight. We always turn our tapes on when we're in tactical mode.
Right, right.
But we were so shocked. We were so sort of overwhelmed in the moment that just thinking through it and making it part of that checklist and procedure that we would have practiced could have brought back more information and more data, which is what everybody craves. Mm-hmm. Everybody wants to know.
Do you think the fact that there was, that you guys weren't given any information ahead of time, and that like none of the flight crews, like none of the, like on board before going out, that you weren't given that information, do you think that's just like a result of the reluctance to think the term UFO or to say it out loud or to?
Yeah, I'm wondering if it isn't possible you were sent up there to perhaps interact with it, but I don't know what the protocol is in terms of scheduling something like that or not wanting something on the record that you're, I don't know. I mean, is it possible that you were, that was the purpose of why you were sent up, maybe under different.
That sounds too conspiratorial
to
me.
I'm just wondering if it's just in like a reaction to stigma or a reaction that there's just a reluctance to address the notion of a UFO at that point, like in the radar room or in the command center, to not, you know, you don't want to say we're sending you out to look after a UFO because it seemed like, I mean, from what I've heard from like I guess Kevin Day, who was the radar operator, they had a pretty clear sense that what they were seeing wasn't normal. Mm-hmm. So do you think there was just the stigma?
Yeah, I can't speculate. I can't speak to what they were thinking, if we're talking about the chain of command all the way up to the admiral who was in charge of that carrier strike group. I was a lieutenant JG. I was only in the squadron for 3 months, and I was, you know, brand new to this carrier operations scene. And so, you know, again, I can't speak to what they were thinking or why they did or didn't act in the time.
Yeah.
Now, 19 years later, I can be frustrated that there wasn't more done in the moment, that we didn't call a training timeout on all of our pre-deployment practice and sort of the sense of urgency we had to check all these boxes to become qualified and certified in order to deploy. I wish that they had the balls to say, hey, let's do a training timeout. There's something here,
right,
and we have all these great assets and operators. Let's, you know, launch some more and see if we can't get some better footage, get some better.
Well, maybe we should jump ahead 19 years because, as I understand it, from, you know, talking to you and hearing you interviewed, that this incident was obviously a big event, but not one that preoccupied your life in the interim. But that's changed in recent years. Like, it seems like it's even changing even since meeting you at the Soul Foundation, and then getting the chance to hang out with you at the Inquiry into Anomalous Experiences and Phenomenon conference that we were just at in New York, that it's now having an impact on your life in a way that maybe you wouldn't have anticipated over the past 19 years? Like, how is it changing for you now, the experience?
So when it happened in 2004, it was a blip on my radar. It was something that happened. It was exciting in the moment. You know, folks talked about it for a few days. And then we were, not that it was a more real issue, but it was a more urgent sense of, hey, we're going to the Gulf.
Yeah.
We're going into harm's way. We're not really sure if that was a threat. We're not really sure what that was. But so there are things that we need to do in order to prepare for this upcoming deployment. And, you know, I went on with my career. I went on with my life. And it wasn't until, you know, several years later that I got called to provide a more thorough debrief and more answer more technical questions about it. And I said, well, what took you guys so long? And I was annoyed with that. But then I thought, well, you know, now that I've done this debrief and I've sort of given them the download, that's it. You know, I won't have to.
Who requested that, by the way? Or are you allowed to? I mean, to whom were you reporting this data?
So folks in the Office of Naval Intelligence. So this would have been the first iteration of like ATIP before it became UAP Task Force, before it became
got it.
So you know, whatever it is now. So
this would have been like Lou Elizondo would have been involved in this debrief, or
not the initial one, but eventually, you know, I met Lou in a skiff in the Pentagon talking about this. But so each time I was asked to come back, you know, I was sort of like, oh man, okay, you have more questions, or you know, did you not write down what I talked about last year? And in some cases there was leadership turnover, so there was a new director, you know, an administration change and new folks were appointed. And sometimes they just want to hear it directly and not read it in a report. You know, this whole idea of a credible witness, you know, looking us in the eye and hearing us retell it, which, you know, that was kind of annoying. I felt like, you got my bio, you've got the narrative that I told you.
Sounds like being on a customer service call where they shift you to a different operator and you have to say the same thing over and over again. Yeah,
exactly.
Very frustrating.
And throughout this time, you know, I'm having my family, you know, I was pregnant or nursing three different children.
Yeah, back to being selfish, clearly. Yeah,
exactly. But, you know, the people say, oh, you were asked to come to the Pentagon, or you were asked to go to the Hill and talk to Congress. It that sounds like a romanticized idea, you know, again, this sort of Hollywood image. But the reality is that you have to fight through DC traffic. And half the time I was in a maternity uniform. You know, I'm pumping in the car in the parking lot, you know, and then like having to go through security, which is like going through airport TSA. You know, it's not glamorous. It's not.
No.
And then you get there, you finally get into the room and they say, okay, tell us what you saw that day. Right. And I'm like, really? I just told you.
Yeah. Tell me something cool.
Last time I was here, I literally told you. So, you know, fast forward to 2021 when 60 Minutes called and said, do you want to come on? Well, I think the way they stated it was that QAnon has convinced Marco Rubio to include UFO legislation or UFO language in the COVID relief legislation. Yeah, you do you want to come on national television and talk about it? And I thought, you know what?
That's a loaded question.
Yeah, I never heard that before, that QAnon had any involvement in that.
I don't know. This is all wires getting crossed. Yeah. But
I know sometimes news organizations will embellish when they're trying to get an interview.
Well, I was actually really impressed with 60 Minutes. You know, they're reputable. I used to watch them with my grandparents when I was little.
Hell yeah, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
They're fact-finding.
And Dan Rather, I guess.
Yeah, they're fact-checking and hung up. Yeah. I told the producer, I said, hang on a second. And I called David Fravor and I said, 60 Minutes just called. He said, yeah, they called me. I was just going to call you. I said, what do you think? You know, is it I've been saying no to so many interview requests. And he said, well, you know, 60 Minutes is a broad audience and they do a fair and balanced job of presenting it. And so you could do one and be done, which was a really naive way of thinking about it. So
it's still a huge step, though. It's a huge step for you to come forward publicly like that at that scale. Did you have to think about it for a minute, or were you like, all right, I'm in?
Well, I didn't see it as coming forward, and I don't consider myself a whistleblower. You know, this was never classified, and this was never being withheld or anything like that. I felt like I was just worn down by all of the.
And your name had been made public just before the 60 Minutes interview too, right?
Right. I remember hearing That's why I was getting so many of these requests. And so I just said, okay. And I felt, you know, as a military officer who had taken an oath and was on duty when this happened, and I was in a taxpayer aircraft, that if there are curious and concerned citizens, you know, that I have this duty and obligation to respond and to share with them, you know, what I can share and to relay, you know, my perspective, that I don't think that there's a conspiracy here, that, you know, that folks who are working the issue, whether it's through now Arrow or at the time ATIP or UAP Task Force, that these are just people trying to do their job. You know, they schlep through that traffic every day to get to the Pentagon, and they, you know, have to spend 45 minutes trying to log in because their password is reset. You know, they're just people. There isn't a big sort of monolithic government that with a singular agenda to withhold the truth from the American people. Mm-hmm. So, from that sense, I felt it was important to talk and share what I could.
And as a result of that, you've become kind of an iconic figure amongst in the UFO community now. And I mean, I've gotten to witness that in person, you know, the attention that, you know, everyone is excited to meet you. Everyone wants to hear your perspective on it. And how is that, and getting out and meeting meeting the community, how is that affecting you?
It's weird. I'm an introvert. That's my personality, by hardwire. And it's strange to be this and I say this with humility, but this hero in this space that I don't understand. I don't get it. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't watch sci-fi growing up. I wasn't into UFO folklore or ufology. I wasn't.
Yeah. I mean, you admitted.
I thought Foo Fighters.
That you hadn't seen Close Encounters.
Oh, I haven't seen any of the movies. I haven't seen any of the Hollywood stuff. I haven't seen any of these documentaries, even the ones that they've been interviewing me for. I sit for them, and then I don't know where they end up.
Were you? So you weren't. So even with the science interest at the time, and I know you liked heroes that brought receipts to the, you know, it was not a curiosity for you what this was growing up. It was just not in your...
No, because Leon Letterman wasn't talking about UFOs.
Right, exactly. Right.
Yeah.
You know, he's talking about science, you know, to potentially a science we don't understand yet, but right. It was more, it was outside of your...
Let's go to Fermilab for a field trip and let's smash some particles together and, you know, talk about the God particle, the Higgs boson. It really wasn't getting into all of this extraterrestrial, non-human intelligence, or even, you know, the sort of from the extraterrestrial to the crypto-terrestrial to the, you know, what did we talk about this weekend? We were talking about UFOs as potential afterlife tech.
Yes.
And death urines. I mean, that's all very fascinating to me now that I'm tuned in. But to your question, Dave, is that it wasn't that I was actively evading questions or that I was hiding information. I just wasn't, you know, I was living my life and I was doing my thing. I was deployed to Afghanistan, boots on ground for a year.
Yeah. No, that's why
I was having babies. I was doing all of that. And then.
This is a recent turn in your life.
The 60 Minutes piece came out.
Yeah.
And rather than doing one and being done, I was bombarded with requests to engage. And I spent about a year sort of saying, oh, you know, what have I done here? And how do I engage with folks who are still curious and concerned in a respectful way? And that's why I opened a Twitter account and said, hey, if you want to talk to me about this, here's a space where we can do it. Stop showing up at my house, because that's kind of creepy.
That is creepy.
That's very creepy.
And, I apologize once more. I'm sorry.
Dave.
Well,
so you know. Yeah, you know.
The cops are in Boulder.
I get excited.
Explains the sirens.
Pretty gentle. Yeah.
But you definitely, you picked up quite a library in New York of signed books.
Yeah. So all that is to say that in the last few months, since being asked to, you know, sort of attend these, what I would have otherwise termed fringe conferences or when people would come at me with, you know, abduction stories, and I'm not saying that they aren't legitimate, but I would just say, you know, what does that have to do with my encounter? Right. I saw something. I wasn't abducted. I didn't have a sensation of being violated or having a loss of control. It is by definition unidentified. Like, we just don't know what it was. It could have been China. It could have been Russia. It could have been Elon Musk messing around. But, you know, I wanted to talk about putting together a systematic method of reporting and a checklist and a standardized template so that when people have encounters, they can get the download it, and then we can ingest it into, you know, this repository, and then we can bring AI and all of our sophisticated technology to analyze it. And then we could figure out not just what we saw, but maybe even predict when we might see something next, right? That's where I'm thinking. Mm-hmm. And then people are coming at me with like fairy folklore and, you know, what does this have to do with sleep paralysis? And I'm just flipping through my notes here from this New York thing.
Diana Walsh Pazulka's, you know, looking at it from a religious phenomena angle. And
right. Like, the ascension narratives.
Yeah.
And so, you know, last year I would have said that's separate. And not to say that it's not important to look into, but it's not related to my experience. I don't understand why people are talking about me and these things in the same breath. And so a few months ago, I finally said, hey, what, you know, why are they? What's going on here? And let me attend these symposium and conference and just meetings and conversations with an open mind and see what's going on here. And so, yeah, it's almost like learning a new language. I kept having to turn to the person on my left and right and say, and Dave, I think you were on my left in New York. I was saying, what did he say? You know, I'm trying to take notes, and I didn't understand the terminology they were using. Mm-hmm. I actually couldn't understand the words because it was and is like a different language for me.
There is a whole lexicon in the UFO community. Yeah.
And I'm not saying that I'm, you know, packing my parachute to jump down any of these rabbit holes. I'm not saying that I'm, you know, a true believer. I'm just saying, you know, what has captured this collective imagination? And why are we spending so much time and energy? Why are there so many podcasts about this?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just saying this from not in a judgmental way, but just in a curious way. Like, well, what is this economy?
Yeah. And it's the...
What is the psychology? What's the sociology here?
I definitely think one of the things that, like, Tom and I have been looking at since we started, you know, this amongst the plethora, and I use that word correctly, of podcasts.
I do not think it means what you think it means.
I do. An unhealthy redolence and abundance. A plethora is not a good thing. It's not just a numerous thing. It means it's
there
not
are
it's
so
much.
Many. So yep. many. I don't know where to start. So if I'm reflecting now and saying that I, you know, not that it was a miseducation of Alex Dietrich over these 19 years, but just that there was, you know, this sort of void of information. Now, when I want to tune in, I don't know where to start.
Well, that's the thing, because it drags you in so many different areas. And it's, Tom and I talk about this a lot, that you keep thinking there's an area that you can ignore when you start to engage with this. You keep thinking, well, that's nuts. I don't need to think about that. And then someone shows you some evidence and you go, oh, or it's not nuts? Oh, damn it. Mm. And I definitely, I have to say that watching you at Seoul and in New York, the graciousness with which you meet these people who are obviously, it's very important to them to have this connection with you. And in a sense, in the community, I think the reason people are so excited to meet you and want to reach out to you and connect with you is that there's a reflected seriousness that comes from you and is kind of gets imparted to other people, that you're involved with this, that somebody who is sort of unimpeachable, it kind of is a balm to the people who have dealt with the, you know, sort of ridicule for being involved with this for many decades. And I think I get a little bit of that myself, because when I jumped into this as a, you know, a dumb TV comedian, even that, you know, made people feel a little less, you know, isolated. But for someone like you to be involved with this, I think it's very, very healing for a lot of people, if that makes sense to you.
It does. Thank you for framing that in that way for me. And I have tried to approach all of these folks who want to have contact, who just, you know, it's so fascinating to me that just, you know, liking something on the social media or, you know, following someone back, then they just gush and they're like, oh man, this is, this feels so good to be seen by Alex. And people who will send me these stories in the DMs where they say, hey, you don't seem crazy. And I don't think I'm crazy. I had this experience. I saw a UFO, or I felt like I was abducted, or, you know, whatever it was, this encounter. And I haven't been able to share it with my family. I haven't been able to talk about it at work. Or I'm a part of my religious organization, you know, my faith group, my church, my mosque, my temple. You know, I would never talk about this in a social setting, in a professional setting. But so here I'm going to give it to you, Alex, and then, you know, now the weight's not all on my shoulders. I'm sharing it with you to carry this with me, to hold this for me. And then I go, oh, thank you. You know, thank you for trusting me with your story. You know, I don't know what to do with this.
I don't right. don't have answers. Yeah.
You know, and getting back to this idea that we need to have a central repository. We need to have a place where people can call in or, you know, go to the app and say, here's my experience. I know it's, you know, let's not talk about whether it sounds crazy or not. Like, let's just get the data and the information. And, you know, I'm an advisor to the Enigma Labs. And so you can download mm-hmm. their app, and not just tell them what you saw or experienced, but also you can, you know, just like any other app, it'll ask you, do you want push notifications? Do you want to get mm-hmm. alerts? But for them, it's, you know, if somebody's in your neighborhood or in your area and reports an encounter, you'll get an alert. So you can actually
that's cool.
go outside and look around and see, you know, and then we can start to triangulate and actually put more and more evidence together. So the story that I ended with at the New York conference was this article I'd read about the neurologist who had somebody come to him with symptoms. I don't know what the symptoms you would go to a neurologist for, maybe headaches or tremors mm-hmm. or things like that. And the neurologist, as any good physician would do, you know, did a thorough intake and asked all these questions and said, when did these symptoms start? And the patient, you know, sort of sheepishly said, well, they started, you know, after my abduction. And rather than snickering and rather than saying, that's nuts, you know, that's crazy, the doctor didn't skip a beat and said, you know, well, when was that? You know, let me get the timeline. And so the doctor treated this individual with respect and dignity and saw this, you know, common humanity, and then proceeded to treat him as he would any other patient and did scans and gave him relief. I don't know if it was medication or what sort of therapies they did, but this patient went off and went back to their, you know, their subreddit or their online group and said, hey, I found a doc who didn't call me crazy and actually was able to alleviate some of my suffering here. And so this neurologist unwittingly became the doc to these abductee experiencers. And you know, in this article and in this research that he published was, he said, look, I'm not saying that these people have been abducted, but I have here a cohort of individuals who feel like they've been abducted, who've had this similar sensation, similar experience, and I've got hard data here. I've got their MRI brain scans. And there's a trend here. They all are different from normal brain scans, but similar to each other. Mm-hmm. And so, again, like, I'm not saying they've been abducted, but something's going on here. So if they were abducted, then maybe that caused this sort of brain damage or this physiology. Or maybe it's this physiology that they were born with or that they developed that is causing them this sensation. And I thought, you know, why aren't more doctors, why aren't more professionals, academics and first responders and, you know, just why aren't all of us sort of getting over our Hollywood conditioning, you know, this mm-hmm. stigma that we've been conditioned to laugh and snicker and dismiss people who say, I'm feeling something different, I've seen something different. And instead, why don't we just pivot and help investigate it? We have mm-hmm. so much hardware. We have so many sensors, from radar and FLIR, RF and optical sensors to MRIs, right? Mm-hmm. We have all of these tools at our disposal. Why don't we bring them to bear to collect more information in a systematic way mm-hmm. and get some answers?
Yeah.
Because that's what everybody is craving.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And it treats the mystery. And I think one of the great things about the way you approach this is, you know, obviously being such a credible witness, a person trained to observe, but also the fact that you're not willing to speculate on everything under the rainbow. I think there is a tendency for people to try to launch in and try to speculate and explain what is inexplicable at the moment. And yet, to your credit, with things like Americans for Safe Aerospace and Enigma, you know, being open to try to gather the information to broaden,
problem solve.
Yeah, to broaden our base of data so that the answers will reveal themselves, as opposed to people launching in and trying to pull things from everywhere, where you start to go like, well, we don't know that entirely. We just don't know. And I think the mystery deserves some respect, because it is so strange and other, and I think, a credit to you for that. And, I think dignifying people's experiences is important. My interest in this started from, you know, an incredibly dear friend who I trusted implicitly having a story and sharing an experience that was so outside of my realm of understanding that it required me to just, that was my personal ontological shock, was like, how do I reconcile this person who I trust and their experience, and trying to just sort of open the aperture to allow it in. And maybe that makes my world bigger or more confusing, but I couldn't dismiss it because, and we have sort of tried with people that we know, like, or have, you know, had experiences, it gives us at least a base, you know, a sort of trust base where we feel like we can share that. With this podcast, for example, just like, because, yeah, I think people's experiences are real. They're valid. Whatever they end up actually being is, we don't necessarily know, but data is important. Gathering it is super important.
Yeah. And empathy and just the simple act of listening, is certainly, it's a gift to the people that you extend it to. And it is an important action in and of itself. Just listening, I think, is incredibly healing for a great many people who are, there's been a tremendous amount of suffering caused by the stigma. And I think you're doing a great service, and just listening to people is really quite laudable. So, and I guess with that, I guess we should just thank you so much for extending this time to us. It's been so great getting to hang out with you a bit recently, and hopefully we'll get to do that again. And
I hope so.
Yeah. So, Tom, anything else you want to wrap up with?
Well, no, I mean, yeah. I think I just think I would love to continue this kind of, you know, hopefully we can keep sort of checking in and having this conversation, and thank you for sharing this. Thanks for your service. I would ask you one thing, like, Mike, because I love your journey. I love that you sort of, you know, what advice, I mean, for girls who want to be aviators, do you feel like, I mean, is the challenge more internal of, like, this is not something that the girls do? What do you tell them in terms of the obstacles? Are they more external? Are they more internal? Or, like, what advice do you give them if they're contemplating becoming a pilot or see it in this sort of old light? I don't know. What's your advice to girls who are thinking about this?
Yeah. Well, I would say just go get some hours. So you can go to any airfield and, work through ground school and work towards a private pilot's license. I think that people feel like there's a big barrier to entry there. And that's why, you know, thank you for mentioning the two organizations that I'm really passionate about. The Legacy Flight Academy, which the legacy refers to the legacy of the Tuskegee Airmen. And so that's an organization that supports and provides opportunities for minority and underserved students to have those, those exposure flights, to just get up and feel the joy and to say, oh, yeah, this, I'm feeling funny in my stomach, or you're like, yeah, this is this, I could see myself doing this, if not for a career, then maybe just for a hobby. I have three kids now, and folks are talking about, you know, the sports and the extracurriculars. And I always remind people that flying in aviation is an extracurricular. And there are organizations like the EAA Young Eagles and the Civil Air Patrol that are almost like Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts for aviation, you know, that can get kids involved. There are scholarships. The Wings for Val is honoring a dear friend who passed in a training exercise on a training mission. But her scholarship is nested under the Women in Aviation International initiative. And this is an organization, and there's an annual conference. And there are lots of these other groups that will piggyback on the WAI train because they take care of all the logistics. But Whirly Girls, for folks who are interested in rotary wing or helicopters, Wings for Val provides scholarships for girls and young women who are interested in pursuing flight. So to your original question, you know, just check it out. You know, go to an airport and find yourself a mentor or get involved in one of these groups and organizations. And I volunteered for Girl Scout Day at the Udvar Hazy, which is the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum out by Dulles. They have one on the mall right there by the Capitol, but then the big one that has the shuttle and the, you know, the Wright brothers, you know, all the planes on sticks, I call them, you know, static displays. And this was, they said, hey, you know, throw on a flight suit and come and make paper airplanes with these Girl Scouts. And I did. And it was amazing. All these girls running around the museum, get a little choked up. Mm-hmm. But then they gave me a case of Girl Scout cookies to go home with.
And I was bonus.
Like, yes.
Yeah.
Total bonus. So there's lots of ways to get involved. And I would say if there's even an inkling of interest that you should run it to ground and see if it's something that you'd be really interested in. There's some people who go out on that first flight and they go, ugh, yeah. This is not for me. You know, just it's kind of like the first time I explored scuba diving. I was like, no, this is not, right. This is not my hobby. So just give it a chance.
Have your kids been able to fly with you, or has that been a part of your life since you've had kids?
So they're still little. Little kids. They're just turned 5, just turned 7, and one's just going to turn 9. So we fly a lot commercially, but I don't trust them. Like little monkeys.
Do you still fly yourself? Ever?
I do. Yes, I maintain actually I have a commercial license through the FAA, but there's two sides of it. One is maintaining the license, and then the other is maintaining your flight physical. You have to go through these FAA physicals every year. And I was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2023, so last year, but a year and a half ago, and had a full bilateral mastectomy, and then, you know, a few surgeries to kind of clean things up and take care of all that. So all that is to say, that I haven't been flying in the immediate, just because I'm
that's a lot to be dealing with.
Issue. Yeah,
but it's a good news story. So they caught it early, the mastectomy, the surgery, caught the cancer, and I share it openly because I want people to go get checked.
Yes,
get your scan.
That's so important. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Well, we're delighted that you're healthy and fine.
Yes.
And that they got it early.
Yeah. Go get your moles checked at dermatology. Go get all the scans.
So and that's a lot to be dealing with when you're also dealing with becoming a celebrity and in the UFO icon.
Yeah. Yeah. No, people were really impatient. They're like, why aren't you getting back to me about my podcast? And I was like, well,
sort of occupied right now. Got a little bit on my plate with three young children and everything else. Yes.
Yes.
Wow.
So, you know, you have to prioritize and,
And
I tell my students, I say you can have it all. You just can't have it all at once. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for those young girls and women who are interested in flying, you know, it's something that will always be there if you want to get started, and you can always go back to it. And I like having it as a sort of a lifelong passion.
Yeah. I once was on a flight with seated next to Buzz Aldrin. And we had a long conversation. It was actually the day after Neil Armstrong died that we were on this flight. One thing that I was surprised by is that Buzz never stopped looking out the window. Yes. The entire flight, he seemed really still excited about being in the air. And after, you know, and this is a guy who went to the moon, and he still just enjoyed looking out that window on a commercial jet. I found that very surprising.
I'm always and forever a hashtag window seat gal.
Yeah.
I always have the window seat.
I always liked the window until my prostate got the better of me. Now I'm an aisle.
Well, I climb over
next to Dave. Yeah.
Yeah. If I have to go, I just climb through, but I got to have the window.
Yeah.
Awesome. Alex, thank you so much. This is great. And thanks for being an inspiration to our next generation of aviators and
aviatrixes.
Aviatrix. I'm up to my ears in my Amelia Earhart research, actually, because she is no primary.
Whatever happened to her?
I don't know. She's not done much lately. That's all I know.
I have some theories.
Everybody.
She's
rude.
Yeah.
She's pretty interesting, but this is just great to meet you, and we'll hopefully continue this conversation, and thanks for being here.
Yep.
Thank you.
Yeah, this was fun.
Thanks for having fun. I like to say that it's, you know, lighthearted, but it's also a serious topic, so I thought you struck a good balance. I appreciate that.
That's our gift to you and the world.
It's Dave's gift, yeah. I just tag along. Thanks, Alex.
Thanks,
Alex. Over and out here.
Hope to see you again soon.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.